The third case set for oral argument this morning is Jeffrey and Powers et al. Versus Turner County Board of Adjustment et al. Mitchell Peterson appears and will be arguing on behalf of the appellants. And then we have Brian Donahoe, who will be arguing on behalf of the appellees, Schmeichels. And Doug Dibert is appearing but not arguing on behalf of Turner County. So with that, Mr. Peterson, you may proceed with your initial argument on behalf of your clients.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mitch Peterson. It's my pleasure to represent the petitioners, the appellants in this case, Dr. Jeffrey Powers and Vicki Urban Riesenauer. While the Turner County Board of Adjustment was in the process of being sued in a 2020 case involving a 2018 permit, the permit holder, Mr. Schmeichel, applied for an identical permit while the litigation was still pending in the fall of 2020. The board, in granting that permit, failed to do several things, including determining what the setback was between the concentrated animal feeding operation housing 7,400 head of swine in the nearest house. They failed to consider evidence of odor and decreased property values, and they refused to even consider the evidence presented by my clients at the permit hearing before the county. Instead of doing what the ordinances require, they rubber-stamped the permit application of their fellow board member, Mr. Schmeichel, at a time they were being sued for the exact same permit. How could they say no this time without admitting they were made an error in the first case? In addition, Mr. Schmeichel had offered to assign substantial grant money from himself to the county as part of a incentive program. The board violated the law. They violated my client's due process rights, and my clients have standing to make this challenge. We ask that this court reverse the circuit court with respect to its determination as to the legality of the permit, but affirm the circuit court with respect to standing and the attorney's fees award. This case is somewhat familiar to this court. The 2020 case, Powers versus Turner County Board of Adjustment, involved the same parties, the same project, all of the same details regarding this particular operation. The circuit court in that case granted the respondent's motion for summary judgment on the issue of standing. This court reversed, applying the Cable versus Union standard, which, while that case was on appeal, was codified by our legislature in 11-2-1.1. In applying the Cable standard, which is now the statutory standard, this court found that we presented sufficient evidence to survive summary judgment, which means it's sufficient evidence to support a verdict in favor of my clients having standing.
So do you think that determination in Powers 1 results in this appeal?
I do. It's the same facts. It's the same legal standard. The result should be the same, too. In particular, the evidence that this court found sufficient for standing was the testimony of Vicki regarding her home that's about 3,000 feet away, just a hair over a half a mile, her plans to have a bed and breakfast, the odor that she would sustain, and the disruption of her life and the decreased property value. On top of that, we had two expert opinions from a world-renowned odor dispersion expert placing complaint-level odor at Vicki's home 72% of the days, and the testimony of a long-experienced appraiser, Steve Shackett, placing a diminished property value of $48,000. The court found that was enough in order to establish standing. Fast forward to this case, it's a new permit, but it's the same facts, same people, same everything. We then presented that evidence at trial to the circuit court without anything on the other side. They didn't present evidence that property value wouldn't go down. They didn't present evidence at the trial court level regarding the odor. They didn't contest any of it. Instead, the respondents continued to bang the same tired drum of, you haven't been harmed sufficiently, you haven't been harmed uniquely enough compared to the general public. But this court has rejected that argument in the 2020 Powers case. It should reject it again this time. Exactly what this court said was enough for summary judgment is what we proved to Judge Giles at the circuit court level. As a matter of law, as a matter of res judicata, stare decisis, this court should make the same decision and find that we had standing, and that Judge Giles' opinion was not clearly erroneous on that subject. after the 2020 case was remanded back to be tried and proceed on the merits, Mr. Schmeichel, now forming a new LLC, Norway Pork, Mr. Schmeichel applied for the same permit before the board in order to correct some of the procedural challenges that we made to the 28 permit regarding notice in the paper and some other procedural issues that they wanted to clean up. The board, at the time of hearing the permit, was aware that they are already being sued for the exact same permit, and if they were to say no, they would be acknowledging that they made an error in the first one. On top of that, we've got Mr. Schmeichel, who is a board member, who was there, not as a board member, but in the room exerting influence on his colleagues. And additionally, the board was aware that they would, as a county, be receiving substantial money if they were to go Mr. Schmeichel's way. So the board refused to consider the evidence presented. They refused, three out of four admitted on the stand at trial that they refused to consider odor, diminished property value, or other negative impacts on the neighbors. And all four of them acknowledged they had no idea what the setback was. They just trusted blindly the zoning administrator.
With regard to your claim that they refused to consider the evidence, can you explain what happened with the expert reports of your clients at the 2020 hearing before the board? It wasn't entirely clear to me what happened or how that evidence was presented.
Your Honor, we sent a copy of the reports to the board prior to the hearing. The board refused to read them, and they all acknowledged that.
So presumably we're making arguments with regard to those reports, or how else did they come into play at that hearing?
Certainly, with the there's always limited time in these cases before county hearings. Arguments were made about odor and why they shouldn't be granted, but they didn't actually look at and read the opinions regarding how catastrophic this odor would be, particularly for Vicky's home.
And I'm trying to understand your argument that they didn't consider odor, at all. Is that based on their admission that they didn't read those reports? Or because certainly it was a topic that was discussed at the hearing. So to say it wasn't considered, that's what I'm trying to understand.
There are two issues. So number one, they didn't look at our reports. So they just refused to even look at the evidence. At trial before the circuit court, three out of four admitted they don't consider odor, they don't consider diminished property value, they don't look at the negative impact on the neighbor. So there's two, and that's required under 1309E of the ordinance. They have to determine a setback, they have to determine odor control, and they have to look at negative effects and odor and other things that can affect neighbors. That's required under 1309E, subparts 1, 2, and 9. They didn't do any one of those three things. This court in the Adolph case, I think there were 13 factors in Grant County in order to grant a CAFO permit, concentrated animal feeding operation permit. The board neglected to do one out of the things. They neglected to look at the environmental violations of the operator. That was enough for this court to find the decision to be illegal because they didn't do what the law required. They didn't follow the ordinances. They just had their own agenda. Here we've got three things the board failed to do. The Adolph case is great authority for this court to reverse and find that the board's decision in this case was illegal and not permitted.
When you refer to the three things, one of the other things you're talking about is a setback. So as I understood your argument, it seemed to be primarily that they didn't independently review the ordinances and do their own calculation. Instead, they just adopted wholesale the county administrator's calculations or determinations. Did I understand that correctly?
It's actually worse than that. So there's two things. There's one, you have to determine what is the setback. How far away does a house need to be from this 7,400 head facility? And then it is, do they meet that setback or not? There's a chart, 1309D in the ordinance, that has maybe a dozen or so different types of CAFOs, whether it's a dairy, a chicken house, or different swine operations. This is a farrow to wean operation. It's not on the chart. It can still be granted on a case-by-case basis. Not a single board member even understood that. They didn't even know that there was that it wasn't on the chart. They didn't know that a case-by-case determination was being made. They didn't even know what the setback was. In fact, Faye didn't even know what the setback, the zoning administrator. It's nowhere in the record that what the setback is. It's just they blindly accepted, whatever it is, it's met.
As a general premise, is there any, why is it problematic for them to rely on an administrator with more expertise bringing a report to them with that administrator's determination? Understanding they still have to make their own independent judgment when they ultimately vote on a matter, but Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with a county board relying on the expertise, input, guidance, recommendations even. But the decision-making power can't just be in that person, especially when the board here didn't even know there was a decision to be made. They didn't even know there was a case-by-case determination to be made.
Was the board aware? The members of the board were aware, nevertheless, that there was a setback requirement provided by the ordinance? Yes.
Yeah, they would have been aware that there was a setback.
So the argument then that they didn't place this proposed facility in the right category, or in some ways didn't calculate the setback requirement correctly, that seems to be a claim of error. Under the narrow constraints of certiorari review, as you know, our cases say we don't really consider whether something's wrong or not wrong. We consider whether the board or the tribunal pursued its authority regularly and acted with discretion. But it's really not the same sort of merits review that sometimes you would see from appellate review. Why, when I examine that argument of yours, why is that just not a claim of error? They just got it wrong. But if they got it wrong, that doesn't necessarily mean, as a general matter, perhaps in this case you have a feeling, that doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't regularly pursue their authority. And to me, those things can't mean the same, because if they do, we really don't have cert review. We've just got de novo review on all these legal issues.
Yeah, here, the board didn't get it right or wrong. They didn't get it. They didn't even make a determination. That's the whole point. It's not that...
Well, they came up with a setback.
They didn't, though. That's the thing in the record. It was just a determination, whatever it is, it's met. Faye says it's met, it's met. There wasn't actually any determination of, on the chart, what has to be done is how many head is it for a base? Because then for every 500 animal units above it, you have to add another 100 feet. So the board needs to decide what is the base amount for this thing that doesn't fit in the chart. They need to make a determination as to what that setback ought to be. That is a judgment call. It's in the ordinances. They have to do that under 1309D. And, you know, particularly...
But what if they adopted, back to Justice Devaney's question, what if they adopted the opinion of a trusted administrative staff member? And that calculation, when I read the submissions, that it seems to me that there's, you know, some criticism about how that calculation is performed. But my question is, why isn't that just an ordinary question of error? And how can we reach that here?
They didn't go through the analysis required.
They didn't do it themselves, or it was not pursuing their authority regularly to rely upon the administrative staff member who made the calculation. Maybe right or maybe wrong.
They didn't do it at all. It's not an issue of they should have made it 4,100 for these reasons, and we think they messed up because they called it a swine production unit instead of a sow. They didn't make any determination at all. In fact, board member Champa was asked, I don't see any discussion about viewing this on a case-by-case basis because it doesn't fit into the animal feeding operation chart. Do you believe that was actually discussed and deliberated? No, sir. And every single board member said that they didn't even know that a case-by-case determination was being made. This is worse than the Hines case. In the Hines case, instead of going through the factors, the board put it up to a vote of the people in the room. What do y'all think? Do you want this project or not? This is even worse. The authority was ceded to a zoning administrator to a vote of one, and they didn't even know what the basis was. They didn't even know what that person was doing. I mean, if you can't put it up to a vote of the neighbors, you can't put it up to the vote of one zoning administrator. They need to make the decision. They are the ones empowered under the ordinance to make a determination. They didn't do it. All four of them admitted under oath, and it's not cherry-picking testimony. It's all over. They didn't do it. They didn't even understand that's what they were doing. It has to be remanded so that the proper authority makes the decision, not one particular person, not a group of neighbors, and all of the fact, and the board needs guidance that you need to look, board, at all of these factors. You actually need to consider odor and impact on the neighbors. I know three of you four don't want to do that, but you have to.
They testified that they were generally aware of the odor concerns. I think that's in the record. Am I correct in that regard?
They were aware it was talked about, but they didn't consider it. They acknowledge that. They have to. Just like in Adolph, you may not want to consider past environmental violations, but if the ordinances say the board member has to do it, the board member has to do it, because those are the rules.
Am I right?
Incorrect legal standard.
Mr. Peterson, I don't know that you cited Adolph in your brief, did you?
I believe that we did. I can check, Your Honor. Yes, on page 22, 23, 29, and 30 of our opening brief, and again,
right,
the reply brief.
Thank you.
Yep. Briefly on the issue of standing, again, I think this is an easy decision for this court. This court's already decided on these facts what needs to be proven to get past summary judgment. We proved that. There was no contrary evidence on the other side. Judge Giles did not clearly err in finding the evidence that this court found sufficient to pass summary judgment to support his decision that my clients have standing. The legal standard's exactly the same between Cable and 1121.1. Even Mr. Donahue's ad on page 7 of his brief that 1121.
Time's up, Mr. Peterson.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Donahoe, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. I am going to address mostly the notice of review issues in this case, but in order to do that, I need to touch briefly on the framework that this court will be deciding the merits, which is the writ of certiorari standard. And in this particular instance, what we're looking at is the question of whether or not the appropriate setbacks or other requirements were met. And contrary to my esteemed colleague's arguments here, those were addressed by the individuals, and the court made findings on that as to the Board of Adjustment meeting in December of 2020. What happened was there had been the previous appeal, same project, and it involved the same land and the same opponents who were residents living in the area. And what happened on that December Board of Adjustment hearing was that they were presented with the written reports from expert witnesses that they had retained as opponents and were arguing the same things that had been presented in the case that this court heard and reversed in regard to the fact issue on summary judgment. That went back down. In the meantime, the Schmeichels in their family farm operation had made some determinations about how they would go forward with this project and decided that they needed to have some operating entities, so they created limited liability companies, one for the real estate, one for the operating. In this case, I'm representing the individuals who are still involved, and as applicants, one of their operating companies, which is the actual company that will do the operation of the facility. It's called Norway Pork Op, OP, for operations. And they came in, and at the hearing, I was their attorney. I argued about how those setbacks were properly determined in the first place in the matter that was remanded by this court, and that we were back before this board for the same project with the same setbacks, talked about the calculations, and talked about the fact that we had determined that they were appropriate and that there was no need to go further into some case-by-case individual determination because of the fact that we're dealing with a matter that does fall under one of the categories as appropriately determined by the board's own administrator, Faye Double D. She's the zoning administrator for the county. She looked at this and said, okay, this is how you do it, and we look at inventory. What does that mean? That means when you have an operation that involves sows, and this is a swine operation, so you have female pigs called sows, when they have piglets, we look at the inventory of the sows and we don't look at the piglets, because the piglets are inside the mother until they're born, and then there's a certain period of time at which they are weaned and taken away. And then they may fall into a different category when we look at these weaned pigs or feeder pigs or farrow to finish or other things. I'm not going to get into the details. We explained all this very thoroughly in our brief. But the bottom line is, when you do certain calculations and you're looking at the period of time we call gestation, that includes through the pregnancy of the sow and after the piglets are born up to the point when they're weaned.
Mr. Donner, the calculation for the setback, and I don't mean to be flip about this, it may be right, it may be wrong. We're here under cert review. The question seems to be from Mr. Peterson, or the issue that he raises, isn't, as he says it, and I hope I'm capturing it right, isn't so much whether it's right or wrong, but it's the question of who decided it. And more specifically, that Ms. Doubledy decided it to the exclusion of the decision makers, or at least that's what I hear him saying. To that, what do you say?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I agree with your analysis, and it's simply whether they got it right or not, which is not allowed under the certiorari standard. And I would point to Judge Giles' his findings of fact in regard to the testimony that was presented. We did present an ordered expert in regard to both the setback and other things that would include that calculation. But the court found, as a matter of law, that, in fact, the board did consider, and at finding 47 in the appendix of the appellants here, it says, it is very clear to the court that after having heard the testimony from all four board members, that all four of them took their responsibility and decision-making authority very seriously. The board members reviewed the testimony and material presented and made their own individual decisions concerning the granting of the permit. If they did, in fact, delegate this to their administrator, they had every right and authority to do so, that would be something that would not be an irregular or unlawful exercise of their authority. So in that regard, that brings me back to the standing issue. Very quickly, I believe we've covered the main issues on the merits. So, right or wrong, they came up with a determination of the setbacks. Importantly, there's also a provision under the Turner County Zoning Ordinance that would have allowed them to reduce that setback. So, assuming that they didn't get it right, and that perhaps the opponents were correct, they still could have reduced that setback. So, first of all, I would say that under the noise case, against the city of Bangor, Maine, which we cited in our brief, and other cases, once you have an alternative basis for the same permit to be granted, they can't be aggrieved. They are not actually harmed. There is no injury here. In regard to all the other arguments that have been made, they've not established evidence here that there is actual harm here. And the standard that's required is that there be an injury that is either threatened and certainly impending, or is not a possible future injury. And that's the only thing that we have in Judge Giles' findings, that there could be a possible future injury. This world-renowned expert they talked about, he's talking about things that could be a moderate, as he called it, odor annoyance problem from this facility up to 4 miles away. And so we've argued hard in a brief that this is a situation where you've got some odor that might possibly be a problem for people away from the facility. But now we're talking about this large area that's going to encompass a large number of members of the rural residential community in Turner County.
This, Mr. Donnell, this court decided in Powers 1 that petitioners had put on enough evidence to establish standing. Why are we addressing it again in this appeal?
Because that was simply addressed in the matter of whether or not there was a factual issue that could not be determined on summary judgment, and specifically that Judge Giles had erred by weighing the evidence. And as a circuit court judge, one would not be allowed to weigh the evidence. Here, this was remanded. We brought a new permit, and that was appealed. And under this new case with the new permit, the court was then in a position to make a determination in regard to standing, because we raised the same issue again. And part of that was based on the fact that in the first case, there was never established that there was any harm. And there, the court was presented with all the evidence. This is essentially a bench trial. And the court made a determination based on all the evidence, requiring the evidence to be weighed in that situation. That's a fine.
Do you acknowledge, though, there's a difference between the threshold showing of standing and ultimately resolving on the merits?
Absolutely. And the burden is on the opponents who are bringing the appeal, the petitioners, at every stage. And at the stage where we were at was the presentation of full evidence, a full trial, essentially, on the issue of standing. They had experts. We had an expert. The court found that Mr. Shackett, their expert appraiser, was an expert, but the problem was he couldn't come up with a comparable sale that showed that there was anywhere in South Dakota or Iowa where he was licensed and where we were specifically looking, because Dr. Powart, one of the opponents here, he lives in Turner County, but drives to Cherokee for his radiology practice. And his testimony was, when I drive across South Dakota and Iowa, I have this terrible smell that I have to encounter from these hog farms. Other people will have this odor. There'll be the perception.
So for purposes of standing, at what point do you have you bring in an expert and you say, we've got experts, they're going to put on evidence suggesting that we're damaged by this facility being built in proximity to our home or to our property. At some point, you set that initial threshold, and then you go on to the merits, don't you? But you seem to be arguing that, well, we got to get to the whole merits of this before we can decide if there's even a question of standing.
Well, this is an issue of determination of the subject matter jurisdiction for the circuit court and for this court.
No, I realize that I realize that we've got to have standing. Parties have to have standing for us to hear the matter, but. That's threshold. That's not determining ultimately who's going to prevail in the case, is it?
No, it's not, Your Honor. And what I was going to say is, so it depends on at which point in the procedure you bring your determination or your attack. And so in this situation, we made a strategic determination that we would not preemptively seek summary judgment or a motion to dismiss. We were going to put everything together, have an argument on the merits and on the standing, so we could get everything done as required under the new statutes that were passed in 2020 that expedite these appeals.
So then I go back to my original question. What changed between now and Powers 1?
We specifically presented evidence to show that there, well, first let me back up. We, again, brought a Daubert motion, but I don't think that was necessary. In this circumstance, you've got a trial court acting as the fact finder, so you've got a bench trial. So the court doesn't necessarily have to do the gatekeeper function and prevent a jury from having improper information from an expert. Having said that, though, you have to, as a fact finder, reject an improperly applied or misapplied methodology from an expert. Or you have to reject those expert opinions that are not sufficiently supported by foundation. That's what happened here. We attacked that on the basis of the cross-examination of the experts, the testimony that was presented to the court, and the court failed to do the appropriate analysis and therefore came to a determination, not that these experts were credible and that they had better opinions, but that their opinions were sufficient because there could be some potential injury based on the perceptions that they presented. That's not the test. Here they did not have sufficient foundation to establish actual injury, and that's where I go back to the comparable sales. If there's not a single comparable sale in any place in the corners of Iowa and South Dakota where Dr. Powers went, then you look elsewhere. I asked the expert, did you look for these sales? He said, yes. I can't find one where there's been a new concentrated animal feeding operation that's been built and it's caused someone nearby to sell their rural residence and to suffer a property loss.
So that's good. That's good argument for the ultimate fact finder. Your cross-examination, but that's a different question than standing.
It is not, Your Honor, for the very reason that that is the foundation that has to be established. Let's face it, if this was a business deal or a bank loan, if you don't get the comparable sales, no deal, period. So then if you're going to come in here as an expert and you're going to establish some foundation for why you can come up with an opinion that's not based on comparable sales, when you as the expert say the comparable sales method is the better of the three that might be available, which he did. He said comparable sales is the way to go, but he can't find a comparable sale. Therefore, you have to have a sufficient basis to say, I will therefore analogize to something completely different. In this case, he chose open sewage lagoons, which have nothing to do with what we're talking about here. As our expert established and their own expert established, there are differences between these types of things, and you have to be able to modify whatever that particular argument is to make the analogy, and he couldn't do it.
So I'm thinking about the weight versus admissibility distinction here, because, you know, as you even discussed, you know, you brought this Daubert motion, maybe you did, needed to, maybe you didn't. But you're saying, as I understand, Mr. Donahue, is that the problem is so endemic with this testimony that it just shouldn't even be considered. And if this had been a jury trial or perhaps some other situation where the gatekeeping function of Daubert was required, the judge would have kept it out. Not just that it would have been unpersuasive in terms of weight, it would have been so flawed that it's inadmissible. If that's the, but that presumes that the opinion had no weight, none, zero whatsoever. The open lagoon theory, all these other things weren't just flawed. They were apples and oranges, and so much so that it was fatal to the testimony. That is stark. I mean, that really means that the testimony was flawed from the get-go. But that's what you're saying, yes?
That is exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor, and that has to be the law. if we look at it this way, how else is a family farmer ever going to be able to establish that someone does not have an aggrieved status in this type of a situation? If we look at that particular evidence, it is either, as I argued, not admissible, a lack of foundation, therefore it is not evidence. Or, as the court determines this because they are going to accept this and it goes to weight rather than admissibility, it has zero weight. It has no weight because you cannot establish a proper basis for taking that opinion. And that's exactly what Judge Giles said. He said it is speculative to say that there will be property value loss.
But he received the evidence.
But he received the evidence. I think that was an error. This court's on de novo review. You can say that.
Did you raise that issue?
I did.
You raise the evidentiary issue?
I did, Your Honor. I did. We argued that. We had closing arguments. I argued that there was no
evidence. Raised it to us, the evidentiary issue.
Yes, Your Honor. That's in our briefs. That's set forth as a matter of the court not being able to make that determination. Before I did argue that. I don't have it precisely in my brief, but that is part of the argument that we presented, is that this was not something that can be considered in this situation. And the best argument that the trial court came up with was that there could be a potential harm at some point. And that's not sufficient under the cable case and under SDCL 11-2-1.1. I see that my time is almost up. I just want to briefly mention the attorney's fees issue. This is an automatic remand in this case because there are no findings, but regardless of that, the court probably needs some guidance on the remand. This is a situation where it is not appropriate to hold up a family farm that's trying to make a $1 million investment and from a practical standpoint can't go forward until these appeals are resolved.
What are the findings factors a court should consider?
I think I'm going to run out of time, but just to be very clear, those are the same factors that they would consider in other cases that allow for a determination of attorney's fees and whether they're appropriate or not. So, for example, in foreclosure or mechanics liens or other things. And there are exceptions to that under statute. So there are a set of considerations, equitable considerations, other things. If it's excessive or if there's a hardship, then there are statutes that allow the court to simply rely on that to deny them. But that was never done here. So I see my time is up, but if you'd like anything further, I would be happy to address that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Donnell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may proceed with your rebuttal, Mr. Peterson.
I'll touch briefly where Mr. Donahue left off with attorney's fees. The eight factors that are referenced have to do with the amount, but there's an opening question because the statute uses the word the court may award attorney's fees. There are factors to consider whether to award them at all before the court even gets to the eight factors about what the amount ought to be. And I learned this the hard way with Justice Salter as the trial court judge in Center of Life Church versus Nelson, where my clients prevailed on a statutory non-disclosure claim, got a $192,000 judgment due to the defendant's non-disclosure of a property defect, and Judge Salter awarded $0 in attorney's fees. We argued that was not within the range of permissible choices, but this court decided otherwise in Center of Life Church based on the factors that Judge Salter discussed, including what is the remedial purpose of the statute. Is there a deterrent purpose to awarding attorney's fees? Is there bad faith on the part of the parties? And have the issues been fairly debatable? Those are the issues this court recognized as those considered about whether to even award a fees, to make a fee award. Those are precisely the factors that Judge Giles went through as set forth in the order. There's no abuse of discretion unless this court is going to quickly change precedent. Center of Life Church is dispositive of this issue, and attorney's fees should not be awarded in this case.
On the standing issue, so Mr. Donahue is focusing on the specific findings the court made, referring to could be possible, speculative in regard to the expert's opinion on diminution in value, and saying that isn't that those specific findings aren't sufficient for the standing requirements. Can you address or respond to that?
Yes, Senator. The speculative is when it was with respect to one particular opinion of Mr. Shackett, but there was other evidence about the impact to the property damage, including the testimony of Vicki, which in Coyote Flats, this court found that a landowner can testify both about the impact of odor from a hog barn and diminished property. It found that two landowners were competent to testify about that. So we don't need to just have Mr. Shackett. But on the issue of the could, I think Mr. Donahue is getting too exacting and too precise with the particular words that Judge Giles used. He found that we met the standing test. This court already found in Powers that the very evidence we presented in this case was enough to get past summary judgment. If it's enough to create a fact question for trial, it is enough to support affirming on a clearly erroneous standard.
Is it enough to be considered as a matter of admissibility?
The court found that it was the information was admissible. The experts are, I mean, they're world renowned. There's three different, Mr. Shacker, there's three different approaches to take.
Yeah, I guess I was just saying, I mean, if our determination in the first Powers case was that there's sufficient evidence, doesn't that contemplate that the evidence that formed the basis of that opinion could be considered? Maybe we didn't consider it exactly that way. I'm just thinking out loud.
I haven't read the briefing from that, but I believe the issue of whether this would pass a Daubert challenge, whether it would be admissible anyway to count for evidence to get past summary judgment was an issue in that case that was briefed and discussed and decided by the court. But even if not, there's certainly no abuse of discretion here, which is the standard on accepting expert testimony and all testimony. In particular, the lack of comparable sales, it wasn't that Mr. Shackett couldn't find a property loss. He couldn't find any houses sold near a CAFO, those that were either lower or higher, no sales. One might speculate that's because they couldn't sell their house. It was so diminished in value. Because of that, Mr. Shackett went with another recognized approach of you take some other proxies, other odor sources, which the court says was legitimate to do. Here there is ample evidence of decreased property value from several sources, invasion of property interest, and intrusion of noxious odors. All of those have been recognized as sufficient to get over the very low bar of standing.
Counsel, can you go back then to the issue of whether the board regularly exercises authority? And you referred to the clearly erroneous standard on the circuit court's findings. So what about the court's findings, as Mr. Donahue pointed out, that the board did in fact consider and make individual decisions after hearing the testimony? So do we review that under the clearly erroneous standard as well? And if so, how can we determine that was clearly erroneous?
It was clearly erroneous. And let me read from, for example, Board Member Austin's testimony, who was asked, did you know you were being asked to make a one-off case-by-case decision because the chart doesn't fit into what's being asked? Were you aware you were making that kind of decision at the time? Answer, no. Every single member answered the same way. They didn't even understand that a case-by-case decision was being made. At a minimum, this has to be sent back to the board.
But that relates to the categorization under the ordinance. Can I finish?
Go ahead.
That relates to the categorization under the ordinance. Is it a special exception, or does it fit within one of the categories? Again, why isn't that just a claim of error? Maybe they got that wrong. Maybe they shouldn't have been thinking about it as a special case like that. But that doesn't, or does it, necessarily mean that they didn't pursue their authority or act within the realm of the ordinance?
My time is out, but I would be happy to answer
the question. You can answer the question.
Under 1309D, it isn't on the chart. Everybody's not on the chart. So it has to go to a case-by-case determination. They can't cede that authority unknowingly to one zoning administrator. Just like in Hines, you can't cede it to a vote of the neighbors. They have to make a decision in order to exercise regularly the authority that the ordinance has granted.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.